everyone. My name is Luis. I'm a faculty here. And I did go through Jesse's lecture. And I noticed that there were some things that you guys requested. And I wasn't planning on talking about that. But I'll try and see if I can squeeze them through in the last lecture. My lectures were aimed thinking about this. And of course, there is an obvious reason for that. That's the type of gravitational wave detections that LIGO-VIRGO detectors are doing nowadays almost daily. If you go to the GRACE DB webpage, if you haven't done it, it's an interesting exercise to see kind of history going in front of your face. In 2015, the first detection of gravitational waves happened, and the detections were a few. The first run of LIGO had 3 detections. The second had over 20. The last one, the third observational run, had about 60. So to that, before 04, the observational run 4, which we're undergoing nowadays, there were 100 events. And now you get to see about, or there are messages that basically send alerts about one per day. I mean, if you're lucky, in a given day, there is more than one. The challenge that we will try and set for ourselves is to try and understand this. So JS already went through the detectors, and how is it that you're trying to catch them through significant efforts on the technological side and very clever analysis techniques. We're just going to go theory land. We're going to assume there is a detector that has arbitrarily sensitivity. If we can find something interesting for experimentalists to search for, they are much more clever than theorists are, and they find a way. So let's just try and see. And as we go, we're going to see the intricacies of dealing with a theory that is very different from everything else. It's a geometrical theory. There is no background. And so how are we going to try and make, in that context, contact with what you may see ultimately in gravitational wave detectors? And I mean, I'm not sure if you know, this tonight, there will be a series of papers that come out for gravitational wave, potential gravitational wave detections. We'll see, depending on what the papers come have, on for NanoGrav. And tomorrow at 1 p.m., there is a big announcement that they are saying they will come out with. And so this is, if you recall Jess's lectures, this is a completely new band. So far, we have had detections that cover the hertz to kilohertz range. This is now the nanohertz range. But we're going to have to wait till tonight.
Is there a plan here to have that be broadcast?
Not yet, but I mean, we'll do it. So I'll talk with...
We don't do it anywhere else.
Eh?
We can do it in this room if we don't do it anywhere else.
Okay, sure. I'll see what we can do, but for sure it would be interesting. And these are all the pulsar timing arrays coming at the same time. So just in case you're interested, there are some notes. So there are many notes on the subject, and there are much of this material is in one book or another, depending on what you look for. I'll just tweak some things here and there for my taste. But a very recent one is these notes by Enrico Barausi, and this is the number in the archive. An early one by Kostas Kokotas. They are a good primer to get in if you're interested. But let's just get going. Of course, it's stopping at any time. I will try and answer your questions. So our goal, as I said, is kind of dissect that signal, understand the propagation, the production, and to some degree, the detection. But that has already been covered by Jess. But I'm going to assume some requisites, so some basic assumptions that I will make in is that you know, and if not, then stop me and we can talk further. Basic motivations and basic knowledge. So is that, okay, if we're describing a theory that's geometrical, our main field is the metric tensor GB. Unless needed, these indices, Lattice indices, will run through all space-time coordinates from 0 to 3 or from 1 to 4, depending on how you count. The signature of this tensor is minus plus plus plus, because why would you use anything else? I mean, there are people that are. I'm going to assume that you know at least the basics of differential geometry.
Applause to start.
Say again. So you know the basics of differential geometry. If you know, don't know, we can talk offline. So this is calculus on curved manifolds, which have some quirks associated to them. But for the most part, we're going to be able to pull up a few tricks, because typically we're going to end up going back to flat space time, because that's, in a sense, the only place where we know how to do calculations to make contact with physics. But this is associated to that metric tensor. There is a natural derivative operator that, when it acts on this metric, it just gives zero. And it encodes the curvature of the spacetime when we do calculations. We're also going to assume that we're going to satisfy, and every now and then I'll just make an exception to this, the equivalence principle, which can be stated in many ways. But locally, we're going to assume that, of course, we cannot tell the difference between a physics that is happening in the presence of a background gravitational field, or physics or with the physics that will be taking place in an accelerated frame. So this tells us we couldn't make that distinction. And this is what essentially let us build all the physics on top of gravity. Locally, all the equations or all the description of any other interaction, any other physics, be it electromagnetism or anything else, will take place in exactly the same way that we have been developing, or people developed in the past, and assuming that the spacetime was flat. And the only thing we had to worry about nowadays is that if our equations are covariant. So if we go into a regime where we say we cannot make distinctions or special distinctions in the coordinates, we need to do something with that. So in the case of electrodynamics, we have to do nothing. It's already covariant from the get-go. But if we have, say, Navier-Stokes equations, like, say, in this incompressible case, that's an equation that looks like so, where these are second spatial derivatives, well, we need to do something with this. And then you work out what the relativistic expressions on that are. And this is the covariant expression of a stress conservation of a stress energy tensor that we're going to have to define in a suitable manner. So this I'm going to assume that you guys know. And if you don't, just let me know. And I'll try and say enough for you to understand as we go along. And we can always kind of catch up offline during the breaks. Are we good? Oh, another thing we can do, because the equivalence principle is locally, so at a point, we can always set the metric to be equal to the flat metric. So this is the Minkowski metric. And something called the Christoffel symbols, which measure kind of the local curvature, which is constructed after the first derivative of the metric tensor can be set to zero. Again, we're going to make use of that as we need. So two more pieces of background information that here and then we're going to use when needed is that, for instance, that stationary tensor for a perfect fluid can be written as some energy density plus some pressure times some four velocity that we're associating to that fluid, speed JB. So this is a perfect fluid, perfect in the sense that we're not building in it any dissipation. So if we take the covariant derivative, the conservation of this tensor, we're going to get the relativistic version of this equation without that term, because we haven't put dissipation in that. So if you ask, what are equations of motion that dTAB equals zero imply? Well, there are essentially two sets. One is a scalar equation, which is when we take this and project it along u. This gives us, if we want, conservation of energy. So the rate of change of the density along u, yes?
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt, but the previous equation, like, confuse me a little bit.
Which one?
That the Christoffel symbols vanish. Can
yes.
Vanish. So that means that if I do like a perturbation around, for example, a Minkowski field, so I can always vanish my perturbation. First order. Describe gravitational waves.
It's going to be in the second order. It's going to be in curvature. So I'll give you another piece of information, another set of another equation that will tell us, okay, how are we going to measure? In fact, so gravitational interactions and waves, etc., will cause tidal forces, and that is in the second order. It's not in the first. So only locally you can put. Of course, locally I can choose my coordinates here that satisfy that. But if I go a centimeter to the side and try and do the same thing, we cannot relate these two things. And this is part of the mess that general relativity brings us into. And then we're going to have to do that. And as you see, once we try and dissect this, we're going to be doing a whole bunch of Frankenstein choices, which are going to be suitable for some purposes and very wrong for others. And so we're going to have to build these things as we go along. But thanks for that question. So, as I said, the conservation equation, if we project it along the fluid flow, then we have what we would call the conservation of energy, and it obeys something, an equation of this type. So the rate of change of the one of the density along the observer that goes with the flow is given by a proportional function times the expansion of that fluid flow. And if you look at what is the component orthogonal to you, well, you get this other relation. Some AA is, I need to define a few things here. So A is the acceleration of the fluid, which is given by along itself. So if I measure the change, the rate of change of the fluid velocity along its congruence, that's my acceleration. And this H is a projector. And every now and then, we're going to introduce this type of projectors. It's the metric minus UAUB, plus UAUB.
In your energy conservation equation, I can't read the bracket in front of the div A.
This one?
Right-hand side, yeah, there's a bracket times the divergence of A. Yeah, what's in the bracket?
Rho plus P.
Rho plus P.
Yeah, thank you. But the main point I want to make, and this, we are choosing a normalization on the fluid for velocity, but the main thing I want to say, if pressure happens to be zero, then we have no acceleration. And so a fluid flow that has no pressure follows geodesics. The other, if you want, prerequisite, and if you don't remember or if you don't know it, please ask me and we can go over it, is the concept of geodesic deviation. And this I'm going to about to answer the question in the back. Can you imagine a congruence of curves that have tangent, each one has a tangent TA. So there's a vector tangent to that, to each one of the flows or the curves defined in my congruence. And I define an orthogonal vector, SA, that measure, if you want, or let us connect one curve to the next one. And this will allow us to measure the distance or how, as these curves progress, they might approach to each other or diverge from each other. The geodesic deviation equation that tells us the acceleration associated to this vector is given by the following. And this goes back to your question. So if you imagine a congruence of curves. This is the second derivative. Yeah, this is
random direction.
Yeah. This is, by definition, the derivative along the congruence of the derivative along the congruence.
Oh. T T is what you were calling u before, I guess,
Well, yeah, it doesn't have to be the flow. So this is just a tangent to that curve. So I'm not tying these two. I'm just saying, I hope you know this result. And if not, we can go over it. But this is the thing that goes to the heart of your question. I could have chosen along this curve coordinates where the metric was flat and the extrinsic and the Christoffel symbols were zero. I can also do the same here, but I'm talking about two different coordinate systems. And if I try to relate what happens in between in a covariant way that is not requiring anything in particular with respect to my choice of coordinates, I realize that the acceleration of the deviation between the geodesics is given by the curvature, by the Riemann curvature. So this is the effects of curvature encoded here.
I also, another just notation thing, relativists talk about congruences of curves. And for particle physics, that just means a vector field? Is that
the Yes. Idea? Yeah. So it's a vector field that is tangent to a whole bunch of curves. So I'm imagining there are these curves, then associated to that, I have the tangents, and then that's what I'm constructing here. The other thing I might say, if you guys haven't seen it, there's something called the abstract index notation. So something when index is up is a vector, when index is down is a covector. The product of a vector and a covector is a scalar, and we're going to go back and forth between them. I think by and large, I'm not going to be using a lot of that machinery, but whenever I do use it, and if there's something you don't understand, let me know. So that's the second piece. Well, let me write here, and then I come back. And the last piece, and this is a bread and butter for you guys, is given an action, or given a Lagrangian, you can always define a Lagrangian density, a stress energy tensor associated with that Lagrangian density by an equation, this form, the variation of your density with respect to the metric tensor gives a stress energy tensor. So if you think of a point particle, so a particle that's moving along, so geodesics are the result of trying to say, as this particle moves, what's a path that will maximize or extremize the distance between two points? That's a geodesics. So in the case of a point particle, what we have is if tau is a proper time along that geodesic, if you can extremize this action with respect to the metric, and two, with respect to the trajectory. So out of this, you get the geodesic equation, which we're going to write as we go along in two different ways. But in covariant notation would be, if you have a geodesic that has tangent TA, it satisfies this if it is parameterized in the right way. But if you vary with respect to the metric, you have the stress energy tensor. So I'm going to leave you an exercise. Show that if you, well, get this. If you haven't done it, again, I can walk you through. But also vary with respect to the metric, which would be in here, in the definition of the proper length along the curve. And just check what the stress energy tensor comes out to be. And so I'll tell you, if you do that, well, you kind of can anticipate, given our previous discussion, what you're going to get. So this is geodesic. Geodesic is not an accelerated object. Remember, we defined the acceleration here that way. And so we said if you have no pressure, the particle follows a geodesic. So you're going to find out that this stress energy tensor will be the stress energy tensor of dust. So that's something that doesn't have any pressure. Again, we're going to use that result later on. All right, so this is the background I'm going to assume. And let me know if you don't know. I mean, there goes the blackboard. So first thing, let's just try and see if we can prove or we can argue that gravitational waves exist and what their main properties are. We're going to have to face our problem. How do we connect with something that locally we have no way of telling if something is moving because we just happen to have a coordinate that seems to have some since we have the space-time have some time dependence, or we have a real effect. So I'm going to tell you kind of the historical way of first obtaining it, which I think is horrible. I mean, after working on differential geometry and building all these geometrical concepts, to do it this way is absolutely horrible, but it's a textbook result. To get it in a formal way that is geometrical, we have to introduce a whole bunch of new things, but it can be done, and eventually I think I'm going to cover ever so slightly that on the last lecture. But let's just follow the standard derivation, because it is the one that assumes the least structure or the least geometrical knowledge. So first we're going to assume, well, if we're going to do physics and then try to understand this is a wave, this is a perturbation that goes around the point, we need to make contact with things we know. And everything we've known up to this point is that has been assuming the metric is flat. So we're going to say there is the metric of a space-time to leading order is the flat metric. But of course, there will be perturbations on top of it. So we're going to try and encode that over a new tensor, which is going to be labeled by this HAB. And of course, we're assuming that HAB is small with respect to the flat metric. Even writing these things, this thing makes no sense in the formal in a formal discussion, because we just said we could choose any coordinate system that we want. So in particular, we could have chosen kind of coordinates where the space-time locally is flat and we're trying to measure something here. Well, there might be some component where this is zero, like this is the flat metric. If you think in Cartesian coordinates, like 1, 2 will be zero. So how is that smaller than this? So that has to be taken with care. But what you say is, well, if we take a general coordinate system, we're going to demand that every component of this tensor, or this matrix tensor, is smaller, significantly smaller than that one. Associated to this, we can also have the inverse. And notice that the abstract index notation comes back. Now I'm writing this when the index is up. So this would be eta AB minus this very same H with the indices raised with the flat metric. That's the inverse. And of course, we're going to ask for things only to be carried out to first order in this H. So the next thing to do is, oh, and that's the last piece of thing I'm going to assume, of course, that you at least have seen at some point that Einstein's equations, which come out from an action, the Hilbert action, is given by this, right? And this is the Einstein tensor that is contracted after the Ricci tensor by the following combination. So this is a Ricci scalar, and this is a Ricci tensor. And this is constructed out of this R1. So our main kind of entity that keeps track of the curvature of space-time is the Riemann tensor. Out of that, we can construct the Ricci tensor and Ricci scalar. Out of that, the Einstein tensor, Einstein equations are like that. So if you now plug this and that into the Einstein tensor, you get a god-awful mess. So let me just write it a little bit. This is what I have. So let me write it first, and then I'm going to make some comments. So if we plug this into the expression for the Riemann tensor, which I'm not giving to you, but if we can make it explicit, what I'm promising is that if you put that in here and keep things only to first order in H, so if you see an H square, you throw it away, you get an expression that is like this. Yes.
This term eta ab and the derivatives, which of them is a? I suppose one is a and the other is c.
The
derivative.
This one.
Ah.
Yes.
A.
CD.
CD.
And this AB.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so where we have introduced H, so remember H is the indices are raised with the metric. So H AB is eta AC, eta BD of H CD. The H is the trace, so it's eta AC or AB H AB. And we have thrown away any possible appearance of H squared. Of course, one thing that you notice right away is that I've written these partial symbols here as opposed to that covariant over there. So that is one of the things, and one of the bonuses that we get when we assume this, that we're computing things to first order, that all those higher, those covariant derivatives ends up being just partial. We can write it in terms of just partial derivatives. So if you try to make sense with this, okay, it's complicated. We don't relate, or we don't see clearly any relation of this equation with something that is more familiar to us. But just let's see if we make some choices, because remember we have four coordinate choices to our advantages that we have not used at all. We have just made an assumption or an answer with respect to how we're going to write the metric tensor. So we could choose a few things. So let me just motivate a few, though this is something that we can do in much more formal terms. So as long as we're dealing with regular derivatives, so I can flip the order. And so notice that in one instance, so something I will have is something that looks like this. So these are, I could try and choose four coordinates where this is equal to zero. So how do we do it? We know that as far as the group of symmetries of the equations, we have this diffeomorphism invariant. So we can always, at least infinitesimally, have if xa were our coordinates, we can change them in this way with some small vector or sza. And we can ask whatever we want to those guys so that some four conditions are satisfied. So we could choose to do that. So this will throw away this. Here, in this term, we're flipping a and b in here. But if we flip a and b, that choice will still be satisfied. So this will drop out. That will drop out. This one will drop out as well. We have something with a trace. So we are then tempted to say, well, maybe we can write this equation in terms of not this h, but a trace reverse h. Imagine you do this. So just take the h and define this tensor, which is related to the previous one, where we just have simply taken the trace out.
Excuse me. Maybe I missed it, but when we choose, we assume that our metric is Minkowski plus h mu. We are choosing a set. We are not choosing a set of coordinates. Then.
No.
Okay.
We're just
saying that it's Minkowski.
We're saying this: the space sum of the curvature is very weak.
Okay.
So
we're not going to a specific set.
We have not. In fact, I haven't even specified what this metric is. So this is a flat metric in whatever coordinates we want to choose. And whatever coordinates we want to choose, for whatever reason, we're going to assume that the departures from the flat metric is encoded by this h. So if we were to replace this in here so that we can write every h in terms of this thing with h bar, then we're going to see that every piece that has the trace drops out in terms of the h bar. So gab under that, it just ends up being. Yes?
That freedom of choosing the coordinate system cannot induce a virtual acceleration in the sense that the metric would perturb way follow-up with respect to Minkowski, similar to the case of on-row acceleration.
Similar to the case of on-row acceleration. Okay.
Over there, the space-time is flat, of course, but the metric can be...
Those are accelerated coordinates. So here, we're not doing that. So we're just saying, I mean, it could be some on-row acceleration. We could be doing these very close to an accelerator observer. But let's see what I want to say there. For the purposes of what we're doing here, what is it? Locally, not extremely locally, but in the neighborhood, we're saying we have a metric is very flat, very close to flat. There's just very small variation. And if we have those acceleration finds, we'll live with those. And then we're going to try and measure these small, the weak perturbations that will travel over that otherwise flat space time, because this is going to be, the physics is going to be here. And if they are accelerated, if there are accelerations due to a trajectory that is accelerated, or a gravitational wave that is passing, or whatever perturbations we have, so be it. So that would be physics, but it's not an acceleration. So that, let's see, what how do I explain that in a cleaner way? Let me say, for simplicity, assume that also we have whatever source is here, and we're very far. We're asking what happens here. So sufficiently far from the source, acceleration, on-row temperature would be essentially zero. So we're in the regime where the space-time is essentially flat, with a little bit of perturbations that are coming from whatever is happening in the source, and then we're going to try and connect with what happens in the source. But yes.
So just to comment on this, I don't think we're doing a full decomposition. We're doing an infinitesimal one. So it's a linearized version of the diffeomorphism invariance. So it can't put you in an on-row frame.
Well, but we could have chosen an accelerated observer, and then we're asking that observer, what are you seeing? So that's something we need to be careful with.
In this linear approximation, can we obtain a quadrupole to have radiation?
Great, and that's what we're going to try and make contact with. So what our assumptions are that we can write this. We are making still no connections with how they were produced. Once we try and do that, we're going to see under what conditions can we make contact with the quadrupole approximation, and that would be the second stage. So as we are trying to dissect the waveform, first we're saying, what is it first? Can we say there will be waveforms in the theory, or gravitational waves in the theory? How many degrees of freedom we have? How do they propagate and behave? And then we're going to say, how are they generated? So we still are not getting to that last point, but you're getting ahead of myself. Thank you. We're going to promise we'll get there. So what we arrive at in the right frame, or in the right, with the right assumption, having chosen to use the diffeomorphism invariant, we can write the Einstein equations in terms of a flat space D'Alembertian operator acting on the stage. So that already is screaming to us there will be waves that propagate at the speed of light. The question is how many? So we count here 10, because we have used 4 degrees of freedom in this choice. So we actually have 6. Is that all? Well, in reality, not yet, because this does not exhaust completely our coordinate freedom. What we can argue for is that if you have, imagine you have, now let me call it 2 metrics, h and let's say h hat and h bar. In both cases, we're talking about having used this freedom to impose this, which by the way is called the Lorentz gauge, or harmonic gauge, depending on what corner of the world you come in. You might have different names for it, the Hilbert gauge.
Is it also the Dunder gauge? Is that?
Yes, also the Dunder gauge.
I think that Lorentz is without the D, because it's not the same Lorentz as the Lorentz transfer.
Oh, could be, I don't know. I I come from here. That's, to me, is harmonic. Because you can also see that if your coordinates are xa, what you're asking is the box of xa is equal to 0. But what you can see is that if you imagine these isomorphism invariants that have taken you here, you can prove that if there are two of such metrics, trace reverse, metric tensor, you will still have the freedom of adding to either one something where the box of z is equal to 0. So you can, if you want a set of coordinates satisfy this, you're free to add, let me just call it y, another piece equal to 0, where this one also satisfies that box. So there is some residual freedom that you haven't used yet, which you can use, and we will use, to knock four more things out of that. So I said we had started with 10, we go down to 6 by that, and then we use this residual freedom to knock it further down, and then that's how we get to 2. So what we have, what we can show is that under these assumptions, there are only 2 propagating degrees of freedom. They propagate at the speed of light. And now we're going to say a few more things on how those waveforms would propagate.
Before you do that, if you had expanded around another background that was not flat, let's say.
Good, I'll get there. Yes. I mean, I might as well just tell you. So we're still going to have 2 physical propagating degrees of freedom of the speed of light. And then we have also some further degrees of freedom that do not propagate. So this is what will tell us, oh, we have waveform propagating on the curved background, and other things will happen. In particular, we no longer have strict propagation on the null cones, but we can also propagate information inside. And this is how backscattering of the curvature takes place.
So does that mean that if I kind of did all those gauge choices, what would be, I used back partial derivatives? Like if I made it d bar hca is equal to 0. Does that mean that when I arrive at the equation, I don't get background box and flux space is 0, I also have curvature term?
Okay, so I might as well just go there. So, okay, yeah. Fine. So suppose, let's just then compare these, and I'm jumping directly what Cliff is asking. In that case, we will say, take the metric and think of it as being some background metric, which is now not necessarily the flat metric, plus some h. Formally, we can still do that. Formally, we still would find that the inverse will respect this with the g background, the inverse of the background metric. We can plug it all through. We can demand the Lorentz with or without a t, the harmonic coordinate condition to satisfy that. And as we plug into linear order, the equations of motion that would be equivalent or the extension of this would look like the box of your now background. It's not the flat spacetime box, but it's a box of your background, HAB, plus, and then, OK, I'm going to be a bit sloppy here with the factors, but let's imagine. So first, we have this piece. So it just tells us it's our degrees of freedom are propagating in the background spacetime. That's fine. Of course, if we have things that propagate at the speed of light, it will be propagating on the cones of that background that is now curved. So they are not necessarily things that are nice at 45 degrees as in flat spacetime. They will have whatever deviation from it that the background curvature has, in particular for inside a black hole, the trajectories will be different than outside a black hole. So that's encoded there. But then we have a non-trivial interaction or non-trivial coupling between the background curvature. This is all evaluated with the background. It's the background curvature with the field itself. So this field propagates, it introduces a non-trivial dependence. In fact, depending on what this curvature of the background is, these can be regarded as having a mass. So now your field is as if it had a mass. Of course, as if you go very, very far from whatever your source is, this r is going rapidly to zero. So if you are infinitely or arbitrarily far away, this thing goes away and you recover back that things are propagating at the speed of light. But this is telling us there is scattering off the background curvature, and similar with this one.
So what is the S tensor?
Say again?
What is the S tensor?
Oh, the S tensor has to do with it's given by combinations of the Einstein tensor evaluated on the background curvature and H's. And the G background. That's all. So this is just so I could write the curvature very cleanly. And asymptotically in vacuum, then this thing goes to zero. The only thing that survives is this one.
And the second term plays the role of mass again, right?
This one could play the role of mass locally. But as we would argue, locally we can't say anything. So unless you're very far out where you say, well, the metric is flat and I can recognize things with respect to that one, well, I may have something that could interpret locally as a mass that might be positive or negative. But whether I have the right to do that, that is a different story. So there will be impact, and this we'll discuss later, hopefully tomorrow, when we talk about black holes and how waves will propagate in the vicinity of black holes, that for some situations, that indeed will be the interpretation. And associated to that, there will be strange but very interesting effects that can have observable consequences.
And is it possible to rearrange in terms of Weyl tensor this equation?
In terms of the Weyl tensor? Yes, you can do that. But that's introducing, it's going in the direction. I said there is a more elegant derivation, but requires further concepts that we introduce.
So because of that background curvature term, does that mean that you cannot have a wave equation, like dispersion equation, as you would normally in flat space?
Absolutely, yes. And it goes back to kind of similar response to what I said before. Because of that, you're going to have weird behavior or strange behavior, as if you were to interpret from the flat space-time point of view. But of course, you're not in flat space-time. This thing is backscattering off the curvature. The curvature, this interaction might help kind of pump up the energy of this guy. And this is a phenomenon of super radiance have to do with that. Immediately, one of the consequences of this is that you don't propagate strictly on the line cone. So you have these tails. And one option that it's better if I do this way. Suppose you have, once we do that exercise and we make the connection with the generation, I can have a source that is doing something that produces gravitational waves. If we turn off the source, we're going to have radiation forever because of this backscattering. Well, if we were doing this in electrodynamics, if we have a source, we turn it off, then the signal turns off, depending on the dimensionality of the space-time. But we live in 3+1 dimensions, so I don't necessarily entertain anything else here. So going back to just maybe say a few words with respect to Cliff's question. So out of here, you can make the same arguments. What's the residual freedom that you have? How many things you can knock off? And you can show that at the end, you can end up only with 2 degrees of freedom that propagate at the speed of light of your background spacetime with some weird interactions. And then you have, in addition, several further other degrees of freedom, which tells you essentially what the background is doing. But this is not propagation. So in fact, some of it is hidden already there. But as far as the degrees of propagation, of course, in general relativity, we're just staying in general relativity. Maybe at the end, I'll make some comments of where, if you open that whatever rabbit hole into non-GR, what the difference may be. But let's just keep it to general relativity for so far. So in essence, what we found is that we have a wave equation which ultimately only 2 degrees of freedom. If we're assuming that our background at least is sufficiently close to Minkowski. So now suppose we have a wave, and this is something that Jess covered in some form, and I just presented a complementary one. Suppose you have a wave that is propagating in the z direction, so let's just pick that. The solution to this equation equal to zero, so imagine that you're far from any source, it's just a sequence of plane waves, right? But we can make these choices and assume that at the end of the day, we have only 2 degrees of freedom. So just let's pick one direction. We're going to assume that the waveform is going this way. So the first observation we have is that our coordinate condition, or the condition that we chose, satisfies this, equal to 0. The solution to this is coming written in general as a polarization tensor times e to the a, let's say, kcxe.
You're using that as divergence of h bar here now, right?
Right, so now I'm going to say what that implies. But the divergence of h bar is 0, and if I chose my vector of propagation to go along z, this implies, so let's imagine that k, so first this implies, if I derive here, that condition implies that ka, aab has to be 0. So
just to make, there was no bar, is that just a typo? Is that the change, are you choosing a different gauge, or is it the same?
No, I'm choosing, so okay. What I said is up to here, we saw very easily that some things we can knock off with this choice, but then there were things with the trace. So if we write, instead of with respect to the unbar, we replace the unbar in terms of the bar, which is the trace reverse, then the trace drops out, and we end up with this equation.
But using the divergence of h unbar.
Yeah, and then this, right, you can choose that, yeah. This, sorry, is with the bar. So you can, they both turn out to be the same. And the one implies the other one.
Excuse me, what's that RA?
Which is what, sorry?
RA?
This one?
No. It's the last one.
This one? Sorry, this is my K. I thought it was a nice K. So what he's saying is K is the direction of propagation of your wave. This choice says that that k happens to be in the kernel of the polarization tensor. And if it propagates in the z direction, the other thing is now you take a second derivative, or you take this. This will imply that ka, is 0. So k is null. But we knew that because we're talking about solutions to the flat wave equation. And so if you now have a vector that is propagating along the z direction, the vector ka is d dta.
So it's like-like.
Say again?
It's like-like.
It's like-like, yes. So the gravitational waves propagate at the speed of light. That's what comes out. Yes?
I'm a bit confused by the notation here, because d dt is just a coordinate. So like, you know, it's like a four-vector component here, but it's like a...
So that, I mean, after we do all this, right, we're free to say, well, given that we're in that coordinate system, we can choose the labels of our coordinates. So
right.
I'm saying in time, and we're in flat, we're doing this calculation to leading order. So everything with respect to the background is, we can assume flat space then. So I'm just adapting my coordinates, so d dt is along the time. And d dz is one vector that I'm just pointing in the direction that the wave is propagating.
Right. No, I get that. I was just confused because of the index notation with the...
Yeah, sorry. Here I'm being a bit pedantic, I guess. So ddt is the vector tangent to the t direction.
Yeah.
And because I'm kind of rather anal about this, I keep the a because it reminds me, you're talking about the vector. Because if I bring this down, right, I have to lower this with a metric, I'm going to pick a minus sign here. And this is, the notation would be dta plus dz a. Then that condition, either applied here, or if I think of it better, or I like better this way, implies that a ta is equal to a za. Right, because the product of k with a has to be 0, or k has to be with a with the intercept have to be 0. I use this one, then I have minus at plus az for arbitrary components of chosen on the a side. And this is where we're going to use that last freedom. I say, well, I anticipated that we have the residual freedom. Let's use it for our advantage. This is where we're going to say, oh, the four freedoms that we have, let's make sure that att equal a z t are equal to 0. Sorry, no, I'm going to use that one. And the other, I'm going to use ATA. I'm going to use this one to set I. And now I is 1, 2, 3. Is equal to 0. And the other one, I'm going to choose that A has trace 0. So if I now put that, all that, and I know I can raise and lower indices with the flat metric, then the polarization tensor AAB, we can write under our choices in this way. I'm going to give it two names here. So for a wave that propagates along the z direction, if we exhaust our freedom, well, I chose that the trace has to be 0, so this tells us this component has to add up to 0, and I have one extra non-zero component that's I call cross. So this is the standard two polarizations that gravitational wave in general relativity have, and they're apparently it was William Press that came with the name H plus and H cross, because to that point people were talking about the polarization that does this versus that, and said, well, why don't we call it plus and cross? So this one, if we have a circle of gravitation of particles and a wave were to go this way, a quarter of a period afterwards will kind of deform it this way, back to this circle, now the opposite, and back to the circle. That's the H plus, and then the H cross, that's something of this form. Again, in a full period.
And one question.
Yes.
We put there these like answers of A, A, B, E, E to the I, K, C, C. But could we have like sums of different modes?
Yes, I mean, this is just the simplest. Imagine you're doing this even in electrodynamics. You're looking for what's the basic solution. The general solution will be a combination of all these modes. So if I'm thinking I'm at a point here and I have a waveform, I mean, multiple waves that are coming from different directions, then on multiple frequencies, then I have to add them all up. We're working at the linear order, so the linear order, we can just add all of them. So, but yes, thanks for that. So the last thing we're going to do, and this is just to think of the detector. So we have just established there are two polarization vectors. So what would be the response of the detector? So imagine again that our metric is GAB equal 8AB. By the way, once we have made these choices, all these choices, we uncover that the waveform is transverse, the H bar is traceless. So the notation that you're going to find often is that after you've made all these choices, do not make it very explicit, then you put a TT, transverse traceless gauge. So you use all your freedom to be there. So let me just use that notation in here to make sure we remember that. So now, let's suppose we have a detector. Let's make a simpler detector. You just have a laser here that is sending its light. It's going to bounce off the mirror, it's going to come back, and we're going to try to see what's the effect of that. OK, we're a theorist. We're going to assume that these two end stations, the one that is producing laser, the laser beam, and the one at the end with the mirror, are in free fall. So it's just doing whatever. And then we imagine the gravitational wave goes through, and we want to know what the effect is. Because very smart people like Jess work very hard to make sure that happens, and that's very difficult. But in theory land, we can say, well, there will be a free fall, and so let's just think about that. So if they are in free fall, the end of this this whatever thought experiments are satisfying the geodesic equation, the equation we wrote here, which if we write in terms of our metric and under our assumptions, can be written in a far more pedestrian way, in the following way. And here I'm going to have to make another salvo. Remember, I said that's the geodesic equation provided we took the right parametrization. We have a zero. Otherwise, we might have something that's proportional to the u. But let's assume we're taking the simplest parametrization. This is why you see a tau here. So this is just tau to indicate, oh, we have chosen that parametrization. Yes?
Yeah, just a clarification here. So when you say in free fall, you mean that we isolated every, like, you know, every like background noise, like for example, if there's like a car passing by or something like that,
or the acceleration of the Earth as it goes around the Sun. So where everything is in free fall. So like we are assuming that the only effect is some just gravitational fall in whatever background background gravitational field we might have. So now we have this waveform that comes along and tries to mess up with that, and so we want to know what's the impact. Of course, it's easier rather than carrying things with respect to this specific parametrization that we're labeling with tau, just to use the coordinate time t. So we imagine that we have laid down some coordinates and we're measuring with respect to that. And so the last thing we need to do is here is to change all the derivatives with respect to tau in terms of derivative with respect to t. So it just involves some derivative between tau and t. And given that xa is the coordinates that we have assigned to either this end or that end, given by, let's say, that way. So the zero component of this equation is the second derivative with respect to t with respect to tau twice. So what I'm saying is that if you plug this in here and you bother changing from the t to the tau coordinate, I'm just going to give you the result. What you find is the following. Where x dot a is dx dt. So the last thing we're going to do is, we haven't evaluated the Christoffel yet. We put this metric in here. And we make the first of many assumptions. We have made several there. Let's make another one. We're going to see if this thing is going to be now, because of the perturbation of gravitational wave through, it's going to be moved. We're going to say that motion is slow with respect to the gravitational wave that is passing by, which is going at the speed of light. So that's a reasonable assumption. So we're going to assume that v, which is dxi dt, is much smaller than 1 or much smaller than c. Yes?
What is the reason that we do not use Fermi normal coordinates? Yeah.
We can do the calculation in Fermi normal coordinates. I mean, here we're just choosing this. I mean, we can do the calculation in many ways. But remember, if we can use Fermi normal coordinates here, and the Fermi normal coordinates over there will be different. So we just have, we're trying to do the experiment. We have laid down this experiment, and we say, well, let's just choose these coordinates. We know that in relativity, they mean nothing, and we're just doing the calculation in one, and we don't want to make any special choice here or there, because if we make those choices, then at the end of the day, we need to combine them with respect to one lab frame, if you want. So I'm just starting with the lab frame from the get-go. Thanks. So tell you, so if you now evaluate what the Christoffel symbol is, yes?
Sorry, about the Fermi coordinates, but we chose the coordinates to fix the gauge, right?
So yes, we have chosen it this way.
Okay. Okay.
Right. So, I thought his question is, can we have tried from the get-go from Fermi-Norco? Yes, it wouldn't have had this shape. Yes. Now, if you plug this in here, use only do it to first order in H, and throw away every time this V shows up because it's subleading. When you end up being able to show is that this thing is zero thanks to our choices. So what happened here? We're trying to see the effect of a waveform. We just set LIGO, we paid $1 billion. No, we didn't. The taxpayers paid $1 billion for the detector to be built, and we have a zero effect. So does anyone want to guess what we did wrong here?
Each one of them separately are zero, but the relation between them.
Right, but if this doesn't change at all, and that one doesn't change at all, how are we going to measure anything? Right, so that one is just doing the right sign. So this is coordinates. Coordinates mean nothing. So what we have to do is just find out something that is invariant with respect to measurements. So the true thing we have to measure is not where they are, but the distance between them. So the distance between them will be, so if L happens to be the distance between emission and kind of mirror, that's the distance between, this is the interval between zero and L coordinate, if you want, of dx, we're only going in the x direction, of 1 plus gxx. That's the only thing that enters. So it's a proper distance between these two points. And then this is roughly, under the assumptions, 1 plus 1 half hxx. So I evaluated a t. And I have to be careful here. So it's the distance, this L coordinate, if no disturbance were to happen and we still were in the flat space-time approximation, that would be the distance doesn't change, is L. Now the waveform is introducing this. Rigorously, I would have to evaluate this integral over the x as this thing changes. But if we assume that the wavelength of our gravitational wave that is going by is much larger, or significantly large with respect to L chord. Well, it really doesn't matter where we're evaluating this thing, so we might as well evaluate at x equals zero. So that's that approximation. And this, at very, very crude order, is what LIGO measures. So we haven't made contact with this yet, but what do you think is the wavelength associated to black holes that are coming together? Colliding. It's a stellar mass black holes. So if I have two objects that are orbiting at some distance, let's call it d, what do you think the waveform that is produced by these guys, what's the relationship between d and lambda? Okay, that's what we're going to do.
It depends also on the redshift.
Yeah, let's imagine it's sufficiently close. It's next door. In fact, at some point, I'm going to give you an exercise. Think of how close you want to be next to the black holes to hear the waveform. I might as well just say now, eventually, remember to do that exercise. We're going to do the calculation, try and find what the strain is of a gravitational wave that passes by. So imagine this is not LIGO. This happens to be your middle ear. So our ear can detect sound waves, which makes the middle ear just move by a little bit. So imagine that as we talk and we're listening, that middle ear moves a little bit. It's, of course, implanted in our facility, which is our skull, which is much more rigid than our middle ear. Gravitational waves from, say, stellar mass objects are in the hearing frequency range. So you can compute based on this, once we know how to calculate this and tie it to the source, what is this change in length, right? That's the natural length. The change in length is given by this 1 half h2 times L. So we're going to try and connect how large h is. And given how large h is, you can ask yourself, how close you have to go so that as a wave goes in, goes by, your skull is rigid, it doesn't change, but your middle ear will do this. So at what point, how close must you be from these two black holes to actually hear the space-time changing? Because you have to have the right rockets and be in the right place and all that, but again, we're doing theory. Okay, this is as far as the propagation of gravitational waves is concerned. Let's try and make contact with the generation.
And what was the relation between lambda and distance?
All right, it's about the same.
Yeah.
It's about the same order. The other thing you notice that here, these are, I'm going to call it non-dispersive waves. The propagation of any frequency in here does not depend on the wavelength. This is different from a rock on a pond, right? Water waves are dispersive. Waves at different wavelengths propagate at different speeds. Okay, this is true in general relativity. Remember, I kind of warn you, every now and then I will say, well, if you open the door to non-general relativity or beyond general relativity, you might have other pieces here, and then you're going to realize that even in that case, depending on the deviation that you're encoding with respect to general relativity, we might have this difference of propagation of different wavelengths. Yes?
Why not 1 plus gxx there?
Good, okay. So the only thing that matters, if we take the distance between here and there in the x direction, is how much the metric is what gxx is, right? Because the metric, the line element, let me just go there. Suppose we're in 2 dimensions. It's this in flat space-time. If we are doing everything, and here is where you should immediately say, wait a minute, when are you making? We don't have lines of simultaneity that make sense in general relativity. But to the extent that we're doing this with respect to flat space-time, we can imagine that to a reasonable approximation, we can do that. So constant time, that goes away. And the distance is given by the dx. But if you now have a curved space-time or your metric tensor, because of your coordinates or because of your curvature, have further dependence. So imagine that you have something like gtt plus 2 gtx dt dx plus gxx dx square. You do the same exercise. You're making these measurements at a given time constant. Your wavelength is, or your distance is not too long with respect to the particular experiment or source that you're thinking about. That thinking that at t equal constant, this goes away and that goes away, then what you have to do is the length is given by the square root of gxx times your dx. Okay, now gxx is, under our assumption, is xx of the flat metric. We're choosing coordinates where this would be 1 plus that. So that's what we have. Oh, no, good.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Sorry.
Yeah, that was a mistake. It was like 1 plus.
Sorry, you should have stopped. Just stop being making a fool of yourself. That's my question. Yeah, I was going. I didn't notice it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm going to erase this until first because. So now what we're going to try and do and see if we can make contact with the generation. So now we have kind of figured out something about what happens at far distances, where the metric can be sufficiently flat. What can we do to connect with the generation itself? And I should warn you, what we're going to do is we're going to cut several corners here and there. Not all of them will be very well justified. The justification might come a posteriori once we say, well, this is the type of sources we're looking about or we're thinking about, but we're going to have to be careful in what we say, and eventually we're going to be able to defend it much more strongly. But let's start that way. So now we're dealing with an equation up to this point that had a zero on the right-hand side because we were at far distance from the source. Now we're saying we're going to deep in the muck. We want to know what this distribution, as it changes, how it will generate the waveform. So we need to worry about what this distribution is doing. So we're going to recover the right-hand side. right-hand side is going to be minus 16 p pi tab. Remember, we said, well, wait a minute. We had Einstein's equation had an 8, and it had a plus. Well, the factor of 2 and the factor of minus come from the contribution that we had in here. There was a 1 half floating around in minus. So this is our starting point. So now what we want to do is how relate this h and that is produced because of something happening with it in the t. So to do that, the first thing we do is just recognize that this can be iterated through a Green's function calculation. So if you remember kind of the Green's function associated to, this is the Dalin version, the solution to box g equal to 0 with a distributional source of this form is given by the integral of our source, in our case is TAB, where imagine that we're observing at some distance x from the source, and we're going to have to add up all the contributions from our source, evaluated at the place where we're observing, which is, say, given by t and x. So this is t minus x prime, x prime divided by x minus x prime. D3x prime. And I, here, with our source is a TAB, so I put the TAB there, and our tensor is the HAB. And there is a 4 floating around because it was 1 over 4 pi in the expression for the solution to this equation. Okay, so here I'm going to tell you I'm going to be fast and loose in a few areas. One is, remember, this thing was transverse and traceless. Well, the TAB is not. So when I'm putting here, in reality, people make this, call it a little t, and this is the trace reverse version of the stress energy tensor. But let's just keep it the t because I don't want it to get confused with something else that we're going to introduce later on. And we're going to remember at some point we really need the answer to be trace free. And so we're going to correct that at the end. So let's just carry it this way. The other thing we're going to say, well, I mean, you just told me you want to account for all the kind of contributions over every little piece of stress energy tensor that we have, but what if that's sufficiently curved? This is an expression that doesn't want it to be curved. But remember, we're making the assumption that to leading order, that flat space M is a good approximation. So we're going to say, or we're assuming that whatever the source is, it's not significantly changing the space-time, or that assumption on the space-time. Of course, there you should kind of also stop me saying, wait a minute, how are you going to use this to relate to black holes that, I mean, affect the space in a significant manner? And this is where I say, well, we're playing a little bit loose with this, and eventually we're going to be able to defend that in stronger terms. So let's just follow that. For the time being, you can consider this as like the sun that is not strongly curving the space-time and is varying, and we're just trying to obtain the gravitational waves that, say, the sun will produce as it evolves. The other thing we're going to assume, that as observers, we are very far. So the x is much larger than the x prime. So if we put some coordinates somewhere here, we're very, very far out. Again, we're going to assume our slow dynamics. And any velocity, any rate of change of things in the distribution of the fluid is slow. So this, as we already said, it means V over C is much less than 1. And so from these, if this is much larger than that, then differences of where the distance is from this point to that or that point to that is irrelevant. So we can pull it out, call it R, and put it out here. And then we start working with this one up here. So then we say HAB. And notice I dropped the bar. I'm being lazy. We're going to kind of make sure at the end of the day that what we have makes sense. It's now a 4 over R, the integral of TAB of that. But in reality, now this t naught minus t is just t minus r, our first approximation integrator of x prime. And the last piece of magic we're going to do, so from here, maybe we can say, OK, we're done. We roughly have an expression that links our gravitational wave as the integral of something that's going on the source, where that's integrated over the source. Let's just try and make contact with really what's going on out there. And this goes back to the earlier question about the quadrupole. Where does the quadrupole shows up? It shows up here. So what we can do is relate this T, AB, which a priori is not very informative, with derivatives of the TAB by the following trick. So I'll tell you first the answer, and then I can tell you where it comes from. So imagine you consider the following, xi, xj. I'm picking already, whenever I use kind of indices in the second half of the alphabet, we're already thinking space, not time. Not the time is out. So we can prove that the following is true. So let's say second time derivatives of t, I can do I. So if I take the second time derivative of tij and dot it with the xi, xj, that this is related to only first time derivatives of the t. I'll give it, leave it as an exercise, give it a try. If not, I'll walk you through it. Once you do it once, you can do it again with no derivative of the t. What are you doing when you try and do that? We're heavily using two things. Conservation of stress energy tensor. We're assuming that's sufficiently flat. We can ignore the perturbations that will any curvature that the space time might have in the source. And then this tells us, for instance, dt of t b is equal to minus di of t I b. So this is the conservation. So this is allowing us to, if you want, replace time derivatives of the stress energy tensor by space derivative of the stress energy tensor. Furthermore, these things we can also relate to derivative, spatial derivative of stress energy tensor, let me call it this way, of products of x times t. Because when this applies to that, it gives us a delta. And when this applies to that, it's giving us that part, the spatial derivative of stress energy tensor. So we actually use it twice to go from a t that is undifferentiated to a t that has two times derivative multiplied by two spatial vectors. So that's a way to change this into the following. So you can prove that the integral in the volume of TAB, so using both integration by parts and as twice the conservation of stress energy tensor, you can choose that this is equal to 1/2 second time derivative is TAB. Or I want T 0, 0, X, I, X, J, X, A, X, I, X, A, X, B. So we can replace this by that. And the last piece is an observation, if you want. What is this? That's the second time derivative of the energy multiplied by r square, or by a distance square. So this goes like the second time derivative of the quadrupole of the source. But we recall that it had to be trace free. So this is a quadrupole. Qij is defined to be Iij minus 1/3 delta ij I, where I is the integral of rho xi xj dv. So we have to be careful once we put all these things together Oh, let me just put it here. We are also, when we're thinking about slow dynamics, when we write the metric as, let's say, even flat spacetime metric as minus dt squared plus dx squared, when we explicitly want to make contact with slow velocities, it's actually quite useful to return explicitly the speed of light there. And so then derivatives like so, with respect to t, pick up c's. And as you do that in this final expression, this will tell, we also, I'm also very fond of dropping the Newton's constant that is supposed to be here, but we also bring it back once we try to make contact with actual observations. And what you find at the end of the day is the following. So that's a final expression that tells us that the gravitational waves that we would measure at far distances are connected with the source by first going down the observation along the cone, asking what is the source doing at that time, and in particular, what's the acceleration of the source, the quadrupole of the source doing at that time. That's what sources the gravitational waves. So in the case, as 1 over r, which is interesting, typical observations in electro with telescopes, unless you're looking at the radio itself, but if you're just looking at the optical, that decays like the intensity, which is 1 over r squared. So this one is the case of 1 over r. So the gravitational wave is much weaker, but at least it gives us that hope that it's decaying slower than many of the observations that people typically can do with telescopes, except if you're doing kind of radio astronomy. But in the observable, the case is 1 over r. There are two things, is why the quadrupole in general relativity, the center of mass and the momentum is conserved. So the first thing that radiates is the quadrupole. You have a question?
Is this only valid for linear motion, or does it work for, I guess, circular motion as well?
So, great. So under the assumption that the field is weak, the only thing you're saying is it's perfectly valid wherever the source is doing, as long as it's isolated, as long as it's slow dynamics, then this is true. And that you're, as an observer, you're sufficiently far. You're not kind of in the muck of that. So you just make that contact. Of course, you, immediately, you also, we have a lot also of questions. That we have two time derivatives, but with respect to what? With respect to what frame are we taking that second time derivatives? Again, locally, we know we can choose a coordinate, but next door in this distribution, how are we going to make sense of the derivative here with respect to the derivative there? This is where the slow dynamics come assumption come from as well. Okay, there are these differences, but the actual implications of those differences are irrelevant to the order you're working. Let me go here and then I go there.
Yeah. So this remark about that that the wave dies out by 1 over r, I suppose it's like, you know. And like, you know, comparing that to saying that, hey, it decays slower than, say, or like, you know, dies out slower than waves in electromagnetism, then it's like, what makes this the desirable thing to measure detectability in that, like, you know, in that it would be, say, proportional to a response signal that you would measure? Like, you know, what if it's just that it happens to be that, you know, h squared happens to be like what's proportional, then it'll be like 1 over r.
Sure. I mean, so let me go back to just in case I didn't say it correctly. So the electromagnetic field also decays for the right distribution, also decays at the slower it is at 1 over r. But in many type of observations, like if you point a telescope in the optical, you're seeing the intensity of the light. That goes 1 over r squared. If you're doing radio astronomy, that measures the field. So depending on what is your measure, you're either homing in on observable that is decaying as 1 over r or as 1 over r squared. Why do we care about this one? It's because the observable in general relativity with respect to gravitational waves is the length of change of something. And that, or the tidal effects of how two particles are being accelerated. A wave goes by, it's going to make them oscillate. And that one is, we're lucky, it's 1 over r. If it had been a higher power, we would have been much more difficult to try and go after them. So in that sense, it just so happens that the effects scale as 1 over distance from the source. And this goes back to a question that you had. It's like, OK, now what happens with redshifts? So yes, first, we're going to make a bit more contact. But yes, that is an ambiguity. And it is a big concern, if you want. And at the same time, it's a big opportunity. Once you go and are detecting things that are sufficiently far that you are sensible to the degeneracies due to the redshift at which the source may be.
Yeah, I had another question. So we said that Lamberti and HAB to 0 to study propagation, and with the TAB to the tensor to study the source. What happens if I have like a black hole or something in the middle of the trajectory? Can I prove with that source that there is lensing?
You can, but okay, so thanks. Once you are in the strongly gravitational field, we're in trouble because we can't define anything. I mean, I can't define what's the mass of this chalk in general relativity. I mean, locally, we have no way of saying that unless we make further assumptions. And we're going to make one tomorrow to try and even ask the question. Because here's the wave. If you ask me, what's the energy of a gravitational wave? We're in trouble. We need to do something more. We're going to have to introduce something. And once we introduce, we're going to even go worse than we have done before. And that all the assumptions that we have made already made some caveats here and there. Careful what we're deciding to assume, because it might no longer be always be possible. We're going to go even worse. At least at everything we've done here are tensors at this order. We're going to introduce something that is not even a tensor to try and define what the energy of a gravitational wave is. So, and that the assumptions that we'll build in are not valid in the vicinity of anything that is strongly gravitating. So then we're going to have to say, OK, we're going to wait and go all the way to infinity to do that. On Friday, we're going to say, well, there might be special cases that there will be some symmetries that we can assume. And once we assume those symmetries, then we can define, again, rigorously some things, in particular maybe a local mass or local pseudo-local mass, pseudo-local angular momentum. But in general, we don't have the right to even hope to have that definition.
And so this formula now makes a statement about the amplitude, so or the strain. Can you, in this calculation, also do and say something about the direction of the gravitational wave, like the k?
So the gravitational wave will be produced in all directions, but you're right. So in addition to this, if we're being very careful, if this is your observer, the observer has a projection associated to it. And so there is a projection in front of here that will tell us whether, say, if these two black holes are going around each other and you're seeing it this way or seeing them this way, there is an inclination penalty that you pay that kind of makes this change, but it's order one. So it's either zero, one to two or something. It's a minor effect, but it has to be accounted for. And this has to do with the direction of propagation of the wave and what its projection is with respect to the direction of observation.
Just to be pedantic, the two R's are the same, right?
Yes. Thank you. So what you could do is just do a quick estimate. So I'll leave this as an exercise. So think of some object that has a given mass, some given natural scale r. Imagine that it's rotating at angular rotation omega. Compute what the strain is for that.
From a spherical symmetry.
No, it's not a spherical. So it's just something. But I mean, just imagine there is here. So from here, the quadrupole would scale like mr square, right? So that's what I'm saying. Just do the wiggly calculation. Now you have to take two times derivatives. How do you take the two times derivatives if you don't know exactly what it's doing? Well, there is a natural time scale associated with this omega. So use that. So it would be like 1 over times square wiggly, which this would say be like I am r square omega square. So if you imagine this is happening, this omega is, let's say, 1 or 100 hertz. Just tell me how big the string is going to be. And it's going to be very small. And that's why you pay $1 billion for a detector. OK, I think I'll stop here. And we're going to continue tomorrow. What we're going to do tomorrow, first thing is to try and get how much energy do these gravitational waves come from. And the next thing is we're slowly just, we would simply have made contact with the speed at which the waveform will be propagating, how they're related to the source. But then we're going to be trying to say slowly how this gravitational wave is to be understood and how do we get physics out of it. Thank you.